This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
We got some Google today. We've got some Chinese economic growth. And we got some Freakonomics, too, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, the 15th of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And there are days, ladies and gentlemen, when I just love, love, love the internet. If you go to Google right now and search antitrust, the first thing that comes up is Google. After a five-year investigation, the European Union said today it's going after the world's biggest search engine for abusing its market power over there by funneling searchers to its own, that is, Google's own shopping site, to the detriment of other companies' shopping sites. This is, as I said, an antitrust case, which means, by definition, it's about competition and whether big, bad Google, whose motto, let's not forget here, is don't be evil, was preventing said competition. But can you, in this day and corporate age, be big without being bad? Marketplace's Stan Alcorn gets us going.
Google is big. Danny Sullivan at Search Engine Land says it's been doing more than 90% of all internet searches in Europe for a long time.
It's been there for at least 5 years. It's probably been there for 10 years. Google has been very dominant.
But how bad is it for one company to dominate a market?
Having a big market share by itself is okay.
Nicholas Economides, an economist at NYU, says big only becomes bad when a company blackmails its suppliers into not serving its competitors or buys up its competitors and then raises prices.
There are many, many, many different types of anti-competitive actions that a company could do to disadvantage its competitors and also hurt customers.
But figuring out whether competitors and customers are actually being hurt, Peter Pacell at the Milken Institute says that is the hard part.
The broad category is restrictive practices, but there is no bright line.
The original big bad monopoly was Standard Oil, which got rid of competitors and gouged consumers more than a century ago. Pacell says in the case of a conniving oil cartel, you can see the harm right in the gas price.
Certainly, anytime a price goes up, consumers are hurt.
But imagine if instead of a price hike on oil, we were talking about a few years of high prices for software or a new prescription drug. Then those anti-competitive monopoly profits look to Pacell more like a reward for innovation, something that in the long run helps, not harms consumers.
It's a term of art, consumer harm, and it has much to do with whether you're looking at the long term or the short term.
To see how differently these terms of art can be hashed out, look no further than Google, which has escaped antitrust action in the U.S., but today defended itself against the EU by saying past allegations of harm have, quote, proved to be wide of the mark. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
There is a business model aspect of this whole thing, a Google business model aspect of this whole thing to talk about. And for that, we've got our brand new tech correspondent, Molly Wood, here. You've been here, what, 3 days and we're putting you on the radio?
Just a hot minute. Here I go.
All right. What is it about Google's business model that makes this whole thing sort of, I guess, inevitable, right?
It really is almost inevitable because Google's goal, and it's a mission-driven company, is to organize the world's information.
Right.
They want to give every user, every search user, the best, most relevant, most useful results. And if that means occasionally buying a company so that they can deliver results from a company they already own, so be it. What happens is that competing companies want you to have a random buffet to select from, and Google says, no, 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 we want to filter that for you, which sounds like a lofty goal, but unfortunately, it leaves out all those other businesses.
So is there a way then to solve this, other than, you know, the EU getting involved regulatorily, is there a way that this ends happily, I guess?
I mean, I think Google would say, be the better service.
Right.
Be the more interesting app, be the better result. The possible way that this ends happily, though, I think where Google approaches the line and maybe crosses it is by buying those companies.
Yeah.
So don't own a travel company, a travel results company. Don't do restaurant reviews, right? Let Yelp surface for restaurant reviews instead of having your own restaurant reviews. The problem is that now they are competing with businesses instead of filtering search results.
Right. And then there's that whole, you know, you have to grow to survive thing. So of course Google is going to buy shopping and of course Google is going to buy groceries, right?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so then the difference becomes, are they putting other companies out of business by purchasing those, or do those companies still have a fair shot at being the better business that shows up on Google?
Right. Really quickly, do you expect that what happened in the EU happens here with regulators?
The EU has had a different standard, but I will say that if they have solid findings, it could cross the pond. Mm.
Molly Wood is our brand new tech correspondent. She is also, by the way, and you guys out there should know this, also the, what are we going to call you, fill-in, substitute, regular, backup host for all four Marketplace programs. So you'll be hearing her all the time. Molly, thanks a bunch.
My pleasure.
Traders didn't give a fig about the EU or antitrust or who did what to whom. Google shares up more than a buck today, 0.25%. The broader markets did just a little bit better. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was news out of China overnight that is going to have an impact on, pretty much everybody. The world's fastest growing big economy is growing just a little bit less fast. Beijing grew 7% in the most recent quarter on an annualized basis. And if you are saying to yourself right now, hello, Kai, I would love to hear numbers like that here or over in Europe for that matter. Yes, you're right. 7% economic growth is huge. It is not huge, however, compared with what China has been doing for the past 25 years or so. So for a little bit more now on how the Chinese economy is doing overall, we've called up Andy Rothman. He's an investment strategist with Matthews Asia. Andy, good to have you with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Are we expecting too much out of the Chinese economy? I mean, we're asking them to restructure and rebalance and yet drive global growth and keep growing at 7% a year. And that's a tall order.
It's probably an irrational expectation. They're still driving global growth, however, at 7%, accounting for about a third of global growth, more than the U.S. and Europe combined.
Tell me what the Chinese economy looks like if you walk around, Shanghai or Beijing or Chongqing or any of those big cities over there.
Well, I was just back in China last week, and I think one of the things that we in America tend to miss is over the last 30 years that I've been working on China, it's become a really entrepreneurial place. When I started there in 84, there were no private companies at all. And today, 80% of employment is private. All the new job creation is private. People starting up businesses in garages, just like in the U.S.
Pick one thing that you look at. When numbers come out every month, over the 30-day month, what's the one thing you look at?
Well, that's probably too hard to answer with one single thing.
So pick two.
Well, what I'm focused on is the job market and income growth.
Interesting that you say the job market. I mean, because that's what we look at over here, too.
Exactly. And so when I'm traveling in China, I'm generally trying to meet with small private companies, not the listed guys that our fund invests in, and ask them, say, hey, how hard is it for you to find new workers, keep your workers? And when I asked that question last week, I was told we're still having to give factory floor workers wage increases of 5 to 8% this year, and for skilled technical people, double-digit growth.
Hmm. Is it, if I'm an average Chinese person, however you define that, can I buy, a car, a house? Have things progressed that much in the past 20 years of 10% growth?
No. If you're an average Chinese person, you're probably not going to be able to afford a car or even your own house. Remember, about half of the population still lives in the countryside, and income there is a lot lower. On the other hand, the number of people who can afford to buy those things is quite big. Put it this way, last year, 10 million Chinese bought a new home, and they paid a lot of cash for that. The minimum cash down payment is 30%.
Should we, or could we, I suppose, infer from the sort of steady decline now for the past couple of years in Chinese economic growth that eventually it's going to be, the global norm of plus or minus 3%?
Definitely. I think the real trick for them is going to be to make sure that that deceleration is gradual without too much volatility. And the other trick for us is to just get used to the idea that, you know, every quarter people are going to be telling us, hey, that was the slowest quarter since the Tang Dynasty.
Andy Rothman, an investment strategist at Matthews Asia. We got him in Hong Kong. Andy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You got till midnight to get that postmark or digital timestamp on your tax returns. Today, of course, is the culmination of a whole lot of document gathering and expense calculating, something that many of us, yours truly included, aren't all that good at. So enter tax preparers. When they are good, they are very, very helpful. But when they are not good, it's a problem. And for a lot of low-income families, it's a big problem. Tax refunds are often the biggest checks those families get all year, which leaves them wide open to tax season predatory lending. Audrey Quinn reports.
On this one-mile stretch of central Brooklyn, there are 9 dollar stores, 11 hair salons, and 12 tax preparation sites.
Can I get your name?
Teresa Butler Stokely.
Butler Stokely's filing her taxes today. She tells me she's way too familiar with feeling taken advantage of around tax time. For 15 years, she filed with one of the major chains. And how much were you usually charged?
It's between $400 and $500.
Butler Stokely was working one low-paying healthcare job, raising 3 kids. And by the time tax season rolled around, she often really needed that refund money, usually quite a few $1,000s. So she'd pay extra to make sure she got it quickly.
It doesn't feel good because you're looking at the amount that you would have had, and then you're looking at the amount that they're going to charge you, and it's like, I know I need this money now, let me just do it.
Butler Stokely says she wasn't stupid. She knew she was throwing away money. But when choosing between getting behind on bills or coughing up a few hundred extra dollars to get a refund quickly, she'd rather cough up the money and keep the bill collectors away.
When you have low-income families and they're getting a big chunk of money, what I like to say is the sharks come circling in.
Chi-Chi Wu is a lawyer with the National Consumer Law Center.
All these businesses have sprung up to take advantage of the fact that these families who are, you know, normally cash-strapped during the year have this sudden influx of funds.
One way businesses do this is by offering something called a refund anticipation check. Refund anticipation loans on your whole refund, are now mostly banned. What the companies do instead is offer you a loan on the tax prep fee. For about 70 extra bucks, you can avoid fronting the fees. In fact, you don't even have to know how much they're going to be. The preparer just takes them out of your refund once it comes through.
What's happening is, if you're paying for something out of a bigger chunk of money, you're less sensitive to the price, right? You know, if you're getting $4,000, having $500 deducted may not hurt as much as, you know, reaching into your wallet and pulling out $500.
That is the industry standard, you know. They all charge the same way because the market bears it.
Hazik Anayat has a tax shop on this mile of Brooklyn. He'd worked for a major preparer chain before, hadn't felt good about how they did business. So he opened up his own shop.
The whole thing about the tax refund kind of has like this mythology behind it. Like, yo, this guy hooked me up with like 5K. He did great work for me. You got to go to him and, you know, he'll hook you up too.
He says it's like tax preparers have built themselves up to be magicians. Give them your money. Poof, they'll make more money suddenly appear.
This site serves about 3,000 to 4,000 tax filers each year.
Right here?
At this site, yes, yes.
Herman Tejeda is with the Food Bank of New York City. They help run free, volunteer-operated tax preparation sites. He tells me the city actually has the capacity to help everyone making under 60,000 get their taxes done for free. This site, just down the street from those other tax prep shops, is where Teresa Butler Stokely is getting her taxes done. She found out about it 3 years ago.
I was in a shelter at the time, and they explained to me that you could get your taxes done for free, and that's what aided me to get out of the shelter.
So the tax refund money got you out?
Mm-hmm, exactly. It was amazing.
You can't see this, but Herman Tejeda from the food bank was standing behind her while she said this. He was straight up beaming. The tax refund, he said, can be a major force for good in people's lives. It's just a matter of making sure that money goes to the person it's meant for. In Brooklyn, New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
coming up.
All those unsold diamonds that people keep because they think of them as investments makes them valuable because they are constricted.
Diamonds, not really forever, actually. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 75 points today, 0.4%, ended at 18,112. The NASDAQ added 33 points, 0.2%, closed at 5,011. The S&P 500 gained 10 points, 0.5%, finished at 2106. You know those ads for cars that can see behind them to avoid accidents or to help you park? Morgan Stanley says it's time to buy Mobileye, which makes software for those camera systems, because they are about to become standard equipment. Mobileye, that's EYE, up 10%. Other auto parts suppliers, Autoliv makes safety systems. Its shares rose 1.3%. Gentex makes automatic dimming rearview mirrors, which, by the way, I never really liked in my new car that I have, up 0.4%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.89%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes in March. A House subcommittee holds a hearing on the worst places to work in the federal government. And on a happier note, tomorrow is National Eggs Benedict Day. On a weekday, I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We live in what has come to be called, in some circles, the 1099 economy, a place where the internet has disintermediated the labor force. And I can get a ride someplace with a swipe at my phone, or I can find a person to clean my house, or any one of a dozen other services. It's great for me, not so good for the labor force that has been disintermediated, where the 1099 economy, named after the tax form that independent contractors get, lets, or maybe it forces, workers to have two, three, or even four jobs. Matt Honan is the San Francisco bureau chief for BuzzFeed News, where he writes about technology and its impact on society, the economy, us, and our lives.
Our washing machine is broken. Despite all my attempts to fix it, crawling around on my belly with a pipe wrench and a plumber snake, all I have to show is a broken PVC pipe, a minor chemical burn, and a mountain of laundry that our family of four has piled up. So last night, I put in an order with Washio, an on-demand laundry service. And this morning, an extremely nice and highly professional woman showed up at our door promptly at 7 a.m., took away our laundry, and left us with a chocolate pastry from a bakery in Oakland. It was amazing. And I feel conflicted about it. It's the same kind of feeling I have whenever I take an Uber or Lyft or use Instacart to pick up groceries rather than going myself. And yet my guilt stems not from whatever her own personal experience is, as much as it does the remaking of the great American economy into a vast labor market of contract workers. The 1099 economy, whose days are dictated by the whims of mobile software, and whose job security is often determined by the numerical star rankings of a capricious and harried market. I spent a decade freelancing, a 1099 contractor, and it was fantastic. I had a freedom most other people could only dream of. There was no boss to answer to other than myself. I made decent money, too. Not initially, but I hustled and worked hard and made it. The American way. But as soon as our first child was born, you better believe I went out and got a 9-to-5. One that came with a modicum of security in case of unforeseen unemployment and health benefits and even life insurance. Because we are all going to die. You are going to die. And the person who drives your Uber will die. And the person who brings your groceries from Instacart will die. Or maybe just get hurt and leave the workforce. Or maybe the startup they work for will fail, as startups often do. How are we as a society going to deal with that? Going to deal with them? What will it mean if we completely remake our workforce of laborers into contractors without the myriad benefits we associate with full-time employment? Who ultimately benefits when they don't? Obviously, the companies who employ, or don't employ, contractors benefit. Even the consumer does, that's certain. Yet the most ruthlessly efficient and pleasurable delivery mechanisms are not always the ones that are best for us over time. Yes, we can all be connected via apps and services now, but first, we're all connected as a society. Washio charges $1.60 per pound for wash and fold laundry. The machines at a nearby laundry are $2 to wash and another $2 to dry, and I estimate it would take me about 3 hours all told to get our great heaping mass of laundry washed, dried, and folded up into piles sorted by size and function. When you factor in our children, our job, and the pipe repairer awaiting me in my basement, the extra cost I'm paying to have someone come get it and do it for me seems negligible. It seems like a bargain. The devil always does.
Matt Honan, he's the San Francisco Bureau Chief for BuzzFeed News. We got a call the other day from a guy who used to be on this program quite a bit. He said he's got some new stuff he'd like to run by us, so we told him it would be great to have him back on. He's even actually got his own music, which maybe some of you might recognize. That's what we in the radio business call a sting. It's the one we made for Stephen Dubner and Freakonomics, and if we're playing it, it can only mean one thing, right? Dubner, how are you?
I'm great. I missed you. I feel like I lost a limb and got it back.
Welcome back, man. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
What do you got going on?
Well, let me ask you this, Kai, a little bit of a personal question.
okay.
I'm guessing, from what I know, that you're a pretty good husband overall. Am I right?
I like to think so, yes. We could check with my wife, but we'll take my word for it. How about that?
Have you ever given her, let's say, a piece of jewelry, perhaps a diamond at one point?
I have, yes. It's been a while, but yeah.
All right. Let me ask you to cast your mind back to then and step into this fellow's shoes for just a moment.
All right. My name's Jason Serrata.
And I am Kristen Serrata.
Jason and Kristen live in outside of Lansing, Michigan. They've got a couple young kids. And Jason has some pretty strong views on family finance, I should say.
Okay.
And he looks at my grocery list and says, why are you getting light bulbs? And I said, well, we're already burned out. He said, they're not burned out. I just unscrewed them a teeny little bit. And I said, well, why did you do that? And he said, well, the energy savings, as well as we don't actually need this much light right here.
You know what I love is he only unscrewed them a teeny little bit so that they still stay in there so she wouldn't notice. But
exactly. Yeah. So that's the Serratas. Now, picture this. A few months back, around Christmas time, they were invited to a fundraiser for a local charity. And it didn't cost them anything to go, but they wanted to contribute a little bit. And there was a raffle for a diamond that was worth $7,500.
Okay.
It's a princess cut, one carat, and it is really nice. A beautiful diamond.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. But come on, nobody ever wins. Nobody I know ever wins those things, right? It's always somebody else.
You don't know the Serratas. You don't know them. They did win.
Okay.
They were very happy.
Okay.
Now, let me ask you this. If you were in Jason's shoes and you and your wife just won this beautiful diamond, what would your first thought be?
Oh, I'm totally going to get into trouble here, but I would sell it. Are you kidding me? Because it's $7,500 versus a diamond? Please.
Well, there you go. You and Jason would be buddies. That was his thought. Kristen, meanwhile, wanted to wear it. And by that night, they were in a fight.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Well, it was not good.
It was horrible.
All right. So what happened? Cut to the chase here.
Well, what happened is Jason hid the diamond in the laundry room way up high where Kristen wouldn't see it. I'm serious.
Seriously? Yep. And how did that work out? That didn't end well.
Not very good. It kind of escalated from there. And so the diamond became part of this vast repository of what I've learned is known as the overhang.
Huh.
The overhang is every diamond ever sold in history that is on someone's finger or in a bank vault or in some drawer somewhere.
That is Edward J. Epstein. He's been writing about the diamond industry for decades.
Well, this is kind of interesting, right? Because the diamond industry itself sort of controls the market, if you will, right?
That is exactly right.
Yeah.
They have kept prices high over the years by constricting demand, kind of matching demand to the number of engagements, for instance, for engagement rings. And also keeping prices high, again, is that overhang, because all those unsold diamonds that people keep because they think of them as investments makes them valuable because they are constricted.
One of the great illusions of our time is that diamonds are forever valuable. They are not.
Right. Especially not if it's just sitting there
in
your laundry room.
Totally.
The other thing is that reselling a diamond for a civilian like you and me is not so easy. The markup from a jeweler is huge, so you can't expect to get all that much if you sell it back to a jeweler, and you don't have that many choices. It's what economists call a thin market. So what the Serratas needed, if they wanted to sell, was a thick market, like maybe everybody. So after a lot of back and forthing, they made a decision finally.
What did they do?
After discussing it with Kristen, we have decided to put it on eBay as an auction. And what we're going to do is donate 50% of the proceeds back to the charity that we won it from.
Oh, that, those are good people. That's smart.
They are good people, yeah. Aren't they? Yeah, yeah. Better than you and me, certainly. So, Kai, listen, if you know anybody that wants to buy a diamond, not just any diamond, the diamond that was won at a raffle and fought over, yeah, and hidden in a laundry room and fought over some more, head to eBay, search for Freakonomics Charity Diamond. I'm going to check back in a week and see if the winning bidder was perhaps one K. Rizdahl.
which it will not be, my friend. Stephen Dubner, one of the co-authors of Freakonomics. As you know, they have a podcast. It is called also Freakonomics. You got it on iTunes. Dubner, we will talk soon, I guess.
I look forward to it, Kai. Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, and yes, sure, fine, call me a dork if you like, but I do love me some Beige Book. The Federal Reserve was out with its 8 times a year regional look at the American economy today, which means the Wall Street Journal's real-time economics blog read it, so we don't have to. Here with the choicest nuggets. First of all, the weather in the Northeast. Restaurant revenues in the Boston area were down 30% to 40% with all that snow on the ground. Apparently, it's been raining a lot in Mississippi and Alabama. Wet, really wet ground there means farmers are behind on their corn plantings. Might switch them over to soybeans, in fact. And from the yes, it is to a tech bubble category, backlogs for architectural companies in San Francisco are the biggest they have been since the recession. So there you go. I'm right. You sell that diamond, right? And you take the cash? Yes, of course you do. The Dow up 75 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 33 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 gained 10 points. That's about 0.5% there. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.